You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Last year, the federal government brought in changes to the Canadian Elections Act, claiming that the integrity of the electoral process was at risk under the old rules. The federal election on October 14th was the first election since the changes were introduced. There were many reports of people being turned away at polling places because they did not have the ID specified in the Act. Jim Quayle is a lawyer and executive director of the BC Public Interest Advocacy Centre. BCPAC filed a charter challenge to the new rules in the BC Supreme Court last year. They're now in the process of collecting affidavits from people who were unable to vote on October 14th. Jim Quayle joins me on the line this morning. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
What was the original justification for introducing the changes to the Act?
That's a little hard to tell. I mean, the reason that's given is basically, as you've said it, to protect the integrity of the electoral system, but there's really no indication that the integrity had any kind of problem, except that we don't have enough people participating, we don't have enough people showing up to vote and feeling engaged in the system.
What do you think was the reason behind the changes?
This has a fairly convoluted history that originates in the U.S., and the backdrop for it is the midterm elections last go around, and you're seeing it played out again right now, like this week. In the U.S., the voting rules for the federal government are set by the states, and a number of Republican states brought in rules like this to prevent people who are likely to vote Democrat from being able to vote. So people who are renters, low income, seniors, various people who would predictably have problems with rules like this would be screened out from the voting process. So that's where it started, and right about the same time, it popped up in Canada, showed up in a parliamentary committee, and three of the four parties in the House of Commons supported the legislation, but nobody could really explain why they were doing it. I actually testified a couple of times before the parliamentary committee, and what the chair of the committee, Mr. Van Loan, told me, he said, all right, you're the legal expert, and you say there's a legal problem here, but we're the political experts, and we're telling you there's a political problem, and we're going to fix it. So that's as close to an explanation as I've heard. I think part of it is a deliberate strategy to try to restrict access to voting. And I think part of it is that sometimes politicians look around for some excuse for losing an election other than the voters just didn't want them.
Hmm. How were the ID requirements changed?
Well, it used to be that once you're on the voter's list, you get on the voter's list just by checking a box in your tax return. You'd show up at the polling place, they'd mail you your voter card, although you didn't have to have that. You'd present yourself and say, here I am. The parties have scrutineers to provide checks and balances. If they're suspicious that there's some kind of a problem, they can object and you can be required to swear a declaration. And they give you a ballot and you vote. And that worked very well. It was an offense to vote fraudulently. But there were almost no prosecutions because, frankly, as I said, our problem isn't people trying to vote too much. Our problem is not enough people trying to vote. Not many people are going to risk fines or imprisonment to cast two ballots in an election where, you know, 14 million people vote. One person voting twice is not going to have very much impact, frankly.
Well, what kind of ID do you need now, then, to vote?
Well, they've got different sort of categories of proof. The simple one is if you've got government-issued ID that's got your photograph and your current address, that's good enough by itself. Now, the problem with that is, and that can be from any level of government, there are no federal government-issued documents that meet that bill. For example, a passport is not adequate because it doesn't have your address in it when it's issued. And there's no municipal documents anywhere in Canada. So the only ones in British Columbia are a driver's license or a BC ID card. So if you have one of those and you happen to have it in your pocket when you go to the polling place, you got no problem. So it obviously is not a problem for, you know, affluent people who drive and so on and have a stable address, so the address on their license matches where they're living. If you don't have that, you had to cobble together a combination of documents that show your identity and your address. So it could be, say, a passport and a hydro bill. If you happen to be the member of the household, first of all, if you live in a home, secondly, if you're the member of the household who gets the hydro bill sent in your name, you could produce a hydro bill. They had a number of different documents like that that you could use. So if you happen to carry your hydro bill and your passport with you, or you're aware of the rules and can locate the documents and bring them to the polling place, you could vote. The third way, if you didn't have either of those, would be to bring somebody along to the polls with you who lives in your polling division. That's not like Vancouver Center. Polling division is a little postage stamp subunit of about 200 voters. So in the West End, it might be one building or two buildings. So you bring somebody who lives in the same polling division as you, and they have to have the documentation that's required, and they have to swear to your identity and your residential address. Of course, another problem in all this is one of the things you have to prove is a residential address. So what do you do if you're homeless and you don't have a residence? You've just lost the right to vote. Another big problem is there's a lot of parts of Canada, for example, a lot of First Nations rural communities, where, you know, people have homes they've lived in for a long time, but they don't have an address attached to the home. So all of these people were put at risk. Now, the parliamentary committee was told that of the latter problem, that there's about 1 million rural Canadians who don't have an address. Whether people are aware of that or not in the cities, that's the case. But they went ahead and just sort of happily passed the legislation. Then they realized after they had just disenfranchised about 1 million people. So they passed an amendment to the amendment that sort of scooped some of them up again. It made this sort of convoluted rule. If you happen to be pre-registered on the voters list on election day, you know, you could go through a rigmarole that would, where you'd be deemed to have shown your residential address. But it means that rural Canadians, by and large, if they don't have a residential address stuck onto their home, can't vote because they can't, unless they are already on the voters list on election day, they can't go and register at the polling place. So anyway, it's created, if anything, more problems than it's solved.
So you mentioned people without addresses, rural people. They would be people who are disenfranchised. What other groups of people would most likely be affected by these new rules?
Well, first of all, people who don't drive and don't have a driver's license. So that might include a lot of people with disabilities who are unable to operate a motor vehicle. Might include a lot of seniors who decide, you know, it's time to give up driving. So that's sort of one category. It also affects people who have moved recently before the election day so that their ID is not up to date as far as their address goes. And so people who are more mobile, like students or renters as opposed to homeowners, would tend to be disadvantaged. First Nations people, as I've said, and the rules, the federal rules say that even a status card is not good enough by itself. And you think about it a little bit, two documents that aren't good enough are a passport or a status card. You know, the passport actually proves you're a citizen and are entitled to vote, which a driver's license does not do. And the status card shows that your ancestors have lived in this part of the world for thousands of years. And if anybody can show sort of an attachment to the location and in principle ought to have a right to vote, it's them, but proof of that status is not adequate. And of course, if you're non-status, you have an even larger problem.
So when you filed your challenge, who did you file it on behalf of?
We had some individual voters. We have a fellow who is a homeless person from the downtown east side and a woman who's a homelessness activist in Victoria, Clyde Wright and Rose Henry, both First Nations people, and also some organizations. We have the Coalition of People with Disabilities, we have the Tenants Coalition, Seniors Group, that's Council of Senior Citizens Organizations, and the VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. So we've got a combination of community groups that speak for constituencies that are particularly at risk of losing the right to vote, and two individuals whose rights were also threatened. And we've just added a third individual who is a retired woman who is visually impaired and was not allowed to vote. They would not accept her her CNIB card, although it has her photograph and her address on it, because it's not on the list.
Now another.
She went to the polls and she was turned away. This is a 86-year-old Canadian citizen who has voted and participated in every election in her adult life and been active in politics and was told, no, you can't vote because even though you've got dozens of cards and bits of paper and plastic with you, none of them qualify for you to be able to vote.
Another voter could vouch for me if I didn't have the correct ID. Were people able to take advantage of that rule?
There no doubt was some of that, but it's the rules are very restrictive. As I say, the person vouching for you, first of all, they have to live in your polling division. So take especially the case of somebody living in a place like the West End. Probably the only people you know in your own polling division are maybe your next-door neighbors in your high-rise building, if you know your next-door neighbors. You know, life is nowadays, so that may even not even be the case. you probably don't know anybody else in your polling division. And the person can only vouch for one other voter, so your next-door neighbor can't vouch for both you and your partner. And if anybody can explain to me the rationale for that, I'll give them a prize.
Do you have any idea how many people would have been affected nationwide by the new rules?
It's just about impossible to tell with any precision. They didn't keep track of how many people were turned away at the polls as they'd show up and they'd say, "Do you have your, what ID have you got?" And they pull out what they got. It's, you know, sorry, that won't work, and send them home, and they may or may not have been able to get back. And also, of course, there's all the people who would have not bothered going to the polls because they know that they didn't meet the rules, and they're almost impossible to count. So it's hard to say, but the chief electoral officer, the former one, Mr. Kingsley, estimated that about 5% of the electorate would have a problem. And as I said, I think earlier, about 14 million people vote in a typical general election in Canada. So 5% of that is about 700,000 people who may have had some difficulty.
Well, it's interesting. If the motivation was supposed to be an increase in democracy, and that combined with a low voter turnout, it doesn't seem like they've achieved their goals.
Well, at least a part of the low voter turnout was certainly people who wanted to vote but were unable to because of the rules. How much, we can't say, but obviously that was a part of it. That was a slice of the problem. We say if you want to jeopardize the integrity of the electoral system, the best way to do that is to stop citizens from being able to exercise the franchise, and that's exactly what they've done. And I want to emphasize this was supported not only by the government, by the Conservatives, but also by the Liberals and the Bloc Québécois, who were really banging the drum on this and promoting this and ready to have it go through the Commons all in one sitting, that is, in one afternoon, all three readings, bang, done. If it hadn't been for the NDP caucus, it would have happened before anybody could even blink.
What section of the Charter are you asking the court to consider in your challenge?
Our challenge is based on Section 3, which says that every Canadian citizen has a right to vote. It's a very simple, straightforward right. It's one of the things that's different between our Constitution and the American one. The U.S. Constitution does not contain a right to vote, actually. So it's a very powerful section. It is immune from the notwithstanding clause, so the government can't override it in any way. And the courts have said that there will be no deference to the judgment of the government or the parliament in the way that they legislate with respect to people's voting rights. This is where the people are sovereign. And the right to vote does not belong to the government, and the government can't take it away. So the onus is on the government to justify anything that might create a burden in the way of people voting. And we think they'll have a difficult time doing that. But it's set for 2 weeks of lawyers arguing in court in the first half of June. So obviously they're going to be putting in a large effort, and we'll see what happens.
Has that Section 3 that you mentioned, that right to vote, has it been invoked before in a charter challenge?
Yes, it has, and probably the most important case is one called Sauvé. The Elections Act also says that federal prisoners cannot vote, and that was ruled in 2002 by the Supreme Court of Canada to be in violation of Section 3. And the court there said a number of things that are very helpful to our case about the power of Section 3 of the Charter. It's one of the sections that, unlike, say, freedom of expression, when you express yourself, you can collide with other people's rights in different ways. You could defame somebody, you could cause some harm in some way. Voting doesn't involve any trade-offs like that. It's just a straightforward sovereign right that everybody's got. And this was reaffirmed very powerfully in the Sauvé decision, and that's going to be obviously a part of our arsenal.
You've been holding drop-in sessions for people to swear affidavits if they were turned away. What have you been hearing from people?
I haven't been personally engaged in that. I must say it's other people from my organization who've been running those, and I'm waiting to see what we get from that. But we do know that a significant number of people were unable to vote or had difficulty voting, and hopefully people are coming around and willing to come forward and have their names go forward in the case.
Now, you're hoping to have your challenge heard before the last election, but didn't. Do you have any idea when this case is going to be heard?
Well, as I said, it's scheduled for, somewhat tentatively, for June. So we expect that there'd be a decision from the court, presumably by sometime next summer. My guess is we're probably not into a federal election until at least a year from now, because the Liberals have to choose a new leader, and the new leader will be given some time, you know, to get ready, you know, to develop a profile and so on. So it's unlikely that that we'll be in the same situation where we go to an election without any kind of court decision. One thing that I might say is that if there are listeners there who were unable to vote or who know somebody who was unable to vote, they should get in touch with our organization. That's our website, which people can look up, is bcpiac.com. That's bcpiac.com. Get in touch with us because we're very interested in getting information and input from people about the scope of the problem.
Well, thanks so much for joining me, Jim.
You're most welcome.
I've been speaking with Jim Quayle. He's a lawyer and executive director of the BC Public Interest Advocacy Center. And if you are unable to vote and would like to swear an affidavit about your experience, you can contact the BC Public Interest Advocacy Center, as he said, at bcpiac.com.